for that. Well, you know that we were thinking last week about Brother Calvin when he was very young. He went to the school called La Marche in France, and then in Paris, and then later he went on to a higher school, the Theological Training Center, where he would become, you know, go in and study for the priesthood. And that was La Montague. And it was quite a difference in it and La Marche, because in La Marche he had a teacher there that was very happy to share the ideas of Republican government and freedom from bondage. The heir of Montague was, however, musty with the old teachings of the scholastics, the schoolmen like Thomas Aquinas and others. And the student with the pale face, the grave and serious eyes, did not fail to satisfy his teachers and even the professors that were so intent on being very staunch Roman Catholics. So his place was never empty at Mass. Never did he violate any of the holy days. He always ate the proper foods on the proper days, and he did not fail to honor the saints on each day. Of course, there are a lot of mythical saints, so-called saints, and of course, Calvin was very active in remembering these saints and praying to these saints each day that they would bless him, as well as the Holy Virgin. And he was so studious in his books, in his longing for more and more as he thirsted for knowledge, that he even skipped some of his meals. And he would stay at the books and he would study late. And the people in that section of Paris noticed that in one of those rooms in the college, there was a dim light that went way into the night and even into the morning hours after all of the other students for the priesthood had taken to their beds. And there was one light still burning, and it burned oftentimes into the morning before daylight, before he would go to bed. Well, this youth, so full of industry and zeal, who was pious, they were sure would rise very high in the church. Oh, this man will certainly be not an ordinary clergyman. He will be a cardinal, his teachers thought. Well, he who was the pride of the college was sure to become one of the great lights in Christendom. Yes, one of the lights of Christendom indeed. The student with the pale face and the burning eye was going to become. Wide around his light would beam. Nor was it the nations of Europe only, sitting meanwhile in the shadow of Rome, that Calvin was to enlighten. But tribes and peoples far off, inhabiting islands and continents which had not even yet been discovered. But the man who had been chosen as the instrument to lead the nations out of their prison house was even at that time still shut up in the same doleful captivity. He needed, first of all, to be himself brought out of the darkness. Calvin, as he spent more and more time studying, he was brought to feel the power of darkness, the strength of the fetters that bound him, the helplessness of being a poor captive. He knew the bitterness of the wormwood and the gall in his own soul. He may be touched with pity in this way, as God was preparing him so that he would understand the miseries of those that he would be called upon to liberate and would continue to toil in patience and faith until their fetters would be broken. Well, he was very firmly armed in his Roman Catholic orthodoxy. He had on a triple armor. He lived in the orthodox atmosphere of the Montague. He was not likely there to hear anything that would corrupt his faith. Secondly, his head had been shorn, and thus he was on the way to becoming a priest. He had set his hands to the plow of Romanism, and he was not about to turn his back. Then again, thirdly, his daily food was the study of the Roman Catholic scholastic theologians, the sound, nutritious qualities of whose doctrines no one in the Montague questioned. The young scholar fortified himself against the approaches of heresy by the rigid observance of all outward ceremonies. He had a mind singularly keen and penetrating and inquisitive. But every day that mind was becoming more one-sided. Every day he contemplated the papacy more and more. Not as it was in fact, but as a youth so idealistic. He fashioned in his own mind how the papacy must be. A few years more, and his whole thinking, his reasoning powers, his feelings would have been intertwined and identified with the system. Every avenue would have been closed and barred against the light. And Calvin would have become the ablest champion that ever enrolled himself in the ranks of the Roman Church. It would be Calvin's name today that the defenders of Romanism used as one of their chief references rather than Bellarmine. But God had provided an opening for the era to even enter in a chink in that triple armor which the young student had around himself. It was a near relative, Calvin's cousin, a Levitan, a disciple of the aged Lefevre, now came to Paris. Living in the same city, the cousins were frequently in each other's company, and new opinions which were agitating Paris and beginning to find confessors at the martyr's stake became the topic of frequent conversation between them. It was very obvious that Calvin, as well as Levitan, had witnessed some of the martyrdoms, because before the martyrs were burned, the great bells of the Cathedral of Notre Dame were rung, and then the people were summoned together to see the heretics burn. Well, Levitan and Calvin were not of one mind on the point of the martyrs. Levitan boldly assailed the Romanist position, and Calvin boldly defends the dogmas of the church. In this humble apartment, the old and the new times met. They struggle the one with the other, and as victory shall incline, so will the new day rise or fall on Christendom. If a Levitan shall be worsted and bound again to the chariot wheel of an infallible church, the world will never see that beautiful version of the New Testament in the vernacular of France, which is destined to accomplish so much in diffusing the light. But if Calvin shall lower his sword before his cousin and yield himself up to the arguments of Lefevre's disciple, what a blow it will be to Rome. The scholar on whose sharp dialectic weapon her representatives in Paris have begun to lean in prospect of coming days will pass over to the camp of the enemy to lay his brilliant genius and his vast acquirements at the feet of Protestantism. There are but two religions in the world, a Levitan argues. The one class of religions are those which men have invented, in all of which man saves himself by ceremonies and good works. The other is that one religion which is revealed in the Scriptures and which teaches man to look for salvation solely from the free grace of God. I will have none of your new doctrines, Calvin sharply replied, "Think you that I have lived in error all my days?" But Calvin is not so sure of the matter as he looks. The words of his cousin have gone deeper into his heart than he's willing to admit, even to himself. When a Levitan has taken his farewell for the day, scarce is the door closed behind him when Calvin bursts into tears. Falling upon his knees, he gives vent in prayer to the doubts and anxieties that agitate him. He cries to the saints and to the Holy Virgin to help him. The doubts by which his soul was now shaken grow in strength and with each renewed discussion with his cousin. "What shall I do? Shall I forsake the church?" That seems to him like casting himself into perdition. And yet, can the church save him? There is a new light breaking in upon him, in which her dogmas are beginning to melt away. The ground beneath him is unsteady and sinking. To what shall he cling? His agitation grows into a great tempest. He feels within him the sorrows of death, and his closet resounds with the sighs and the groans like those walls in Erfurt that heard Luther some time before. This tempest was not in the intellect, although doubtless the darkness of his understanding had to do with it. Its seat was the soul, the conscience. It consisted in a sense of guilt, a consciousness of vileness, and a shuddering apprehension of wrath. So long as he had to do merely with the saints, creatures like himself, only a little holier, it might be, all was well. But now he was standing in the presence of that infinitely holy one with whom evil cannot dwell. He was standing there, the blackness and vileness of his sin shining forth in the clear light of the divine purity. He was standing there, the transgressor of a law that says, "The soul that sinneth, it shall die." That death, how awful. "What shall I do?" he says. Well, he was standing there with all that he had formerly trusted, saints and rites and good works, and yet they were swept away. None of them could protect him from the arm of the lawgiver. He had come to a judge without an advocate. It did not occur to him before that he needed an advocate, at least other than Rome provides, because before he saw neither God's holiness, nor did he see his own guilt in its awful, glaring reality. He saw both a holy God and an unholy heart.